Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Benjamin Weinberg, MD, to discuss key takeaways from the 2020 ASCO Virtual Scientific Program in colorectal cancer. Among the most notable studies that were presented in CRC was the Phase 3 KEYNOTE-177 trial, which showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in patients with microsatellite instability high mismatch repair deficient disease. Moreover, in the Phase 2 DESTINY-CRC01 trial, trastuzumab deruxtecan showed early signs of clinical activity in heavily pretreated patients with metastatic HER2-positive CRC. For patients with liver metastases, data from the Phase 2-3 JCOG-0603 trial suggested that patients undergoing curative hepatectomy for CRC liver metastases should not be given adjuvant FOLFOX chemotherapy due to the lack of overall survival benefit. In the radiation space, findings from the RAPIDO study demonstrated that short-course radiation is similar to traditional chemoradiation with regard to survival benefit, but superior in terms of the time to disease-related failure. Finally, the field received data from the IDEA trial, which showed that the only group of patients who should be considered for 6 months of FOLFOX are patients with T4 and/or N2 disease. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Weinberg, an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center at Georgetown University, MedStar Health, shared the clinical implications of these data in the treatment of patients with CRC and projected what the future may hold in the space. Thank you again, Dr. Weinberg, for joining me today to talk about the post-ASCO recap in colorectal cancer. To start, could you discuss the KEYNOTE-177 trial and its implications for patients with microsatellite instability high or mismatch repair deficient disease?
Sure. So the KEYNOTE-177 study was a plenary discussion at ASCO 2020, which is reserved for the highest level abstracts across all cancer types. And we always like it when a GI cancer trial gets selected. It doesn't happen every year, but this year it happened, and I think for a good reason, because this study really showed that patients with microsatellite instability high or mismatch repair deficient colorectal cancer that's metastatic should really probably be receiving immunotherapy in the first line setting instead of chemotherapy. So this was a fairly large phase 3 trial where patients with MSI high or MMRD stage 4 colorectal cancer that were treatment naive were randomized 1-to-1 to pembrolizumab or dealer's choice chemotherapy, which could be FOLFOX, FOLFIRI with or without biologics. And patients did have an optional crossover on the chemo arm to go to immunotherapy. And it wasn't blinded, obviously, because that would be very complicated. And there were two sort of primary endpoints. One was progression-free survival. One was overall survival. Here, they actually only present officially the progression-free survival results, but they were pretty dramatic. Interestingly, patients who are on the immunotherapy arm, there were a group of them who progressed rather quickly. And actually, the curves sort of overlap, as we often see when immunotherapy is compared directly to chemotherapy, that if there's an immunotherapy benefit, it's really more at the tail end than at the initial part of the study. And we saw that here as well. The median progression-free survival was still pretty dramatic. It was 8.2 months with chemo, 16.5 months with pembrolizumab with a hazard ratio of 0.6 and statistically significant. So this is very impressive. And if you look at the landmark survival at 12 and 24 months, 55% of those with pembrolizumab were progression-free at 12 months, 48% were still progression-free at 2 years, 24 months. Whereas with chemo, only 37% were progression-free at 12 months and only 19% were progression-free at 24 months. So again, there's a big tail here, and it looks like, you know, hard to say because there's less long-term follow-up after 3 years, but there's probably around 40% of folks who are still progression-free at the 36-month mark, give or take. Whereas with chemo, know, it's, you know, less than 10%. So there does seem to be a long tail, and we await the overall survival results that will probably be confounded again a little bit by the crossover. And the other thing, again, to note is that 29.4% of patients with pembrolizumab had progressive disease as their best response, whereas only 12% with chemo had progressive disease as the best response. So it shows that there is almost a third of patients who have fairly rapid progression on pembrolizumab despite being MSI high MMRD. And we need to try to figure out exactly why this is happening. We don't really know exactly based on the results presented, but maybe patients with RAS mutations may not respond to pembrolizumab as well. BRAF didn't seem to matter as much. I'd be interested to look at what the tumor mutational burden is among patients who didn't respond. And my own specific interest in microbiome, is there more specific bacteria, such as bacteria like Fusobacterium nucleatum, that seems to track with MSI high cancers and leads to a lower tumor infiltrating lymphocyte rate or density, and that this might be negatively impacting those responses we see in this subset of patients. So what does it all come down to? The other big thing to note is that from an adverse event rate, the severe adverse events were about a third in pembrolizumab. Only 22% had grade 3 or higher adverse events, whereas 66% with chemotherapy. So you see a dramatic reduction also in the adverse event rates while seeing this big boost in progression-free survival. So looking forward, you know, what does this mean? So we probably shouldn't be giving chemo by itself to these patients. So there are other studies looking at combining chemo VEGF inhibition with immunotherapy, and then other studies looking at combination immunotherapy with combined PD-1 and CTLA-4 blockade. So I think we'll get some more information out of those. Some of the best numerical data we've seen is with combination of avelumab, ipilimumab. So it'll be interesting to see that data bear out compared to this monotherapy data. So all in all, it's a very high level presentation, and we await to see the publication of these results.
Trastuzumab deruxtecan has shown, you know, unprecedented efficacy in HER2-positive breast cancer. So what is the story with that antibody-drug conjugate in HER2-positive CRC? And if you could go into the data presented with the DESTINY-CRC01 study.
Right. So in GI cancers, especially upper GI cancers that are HER2-positive, and to a lesser extent colorectal cancers that are HER2-positive, we sort of inherit these drugs or repurpose drugs from the breast cancer world, and we're grateful for that. But we have to make sure it works because our tumor biology is a little bit different. So this is an interesting novel compound. It's an antibody drug conjugate. And what that means is one end of the drug has a HER2 moiety that is an IgG1 monoclonal antibody that is very similar to the sequence in trastuzumab. And then it has this linker, a tetrapeptide-based linker that's cleavable that can unleash this topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload, which is similar to irinotecan. And so it's sort of a smart bomb approach. We use the HER2 as the target, and that's the sort of lock and key, and then the payload is chemotherapy. And so this was a study looking at this drug specifically in patients with HER2-expressing metastatic or unresectable colorectal cancer. They had to be RAS and BRAF wild type, which is typical of patients that are HER2 overexpressed. Interestingly, the study allowed prior anti-HER2 therapy, and everybody on the study had prior irinotecan. And they looked at a couple different cohorts due to variable HER2 expression. And suffice it to say that the patients that really benefited were the ones that we typically think of strongly HER2 positive, those that are IHC 3+ and or IHC 2+ with positive in situ hybridization. So they were looking mainly at this group, and it was a heavily pretreated group. Again, that was really all RAS, BRAF wild type. All had had prior irinotecan. All had had prior 5-FU, oxaliplatin, EGFR. The vast majority had had prior bevacizumab, and about a third had had prior HER2 therapy, including a variety of different HER2 targeting agents. So the impressive takeaway from this study was the response rate, again, in a chemo-refractory, HER2 often not naive or HER2 experienced group. The response rate overall was 45%. Very few complete responses, only one, but 43% had a partial response, and almost 38% had stable disease, with a disease control rate of 83% and a duration of response that wasn't reached. And the waterfall plot was very impressive, especially when you specifically look at patients with IHC 3+ disease, didn't seem to matter if they'd had prior anti-HER2 therapy or not. The waterfall plot was very impressive for this cohort. And these responses, as I mentioned, were pretty durable. So the only thing that really seemed to determine the response was, the rate of HER2 positivity. So definitely better in the IHC 3 plus group. And overall for this group, progression-free survival was 6.9 months, which is pretty impressive for a later line study. And median overall survival actually wasn't actually reached yet. And the safety of the drug is relatively safe. However, there are some specific events surrounding pneumonitis and interstitial lung disease that seem to play a specific role with this drug. And there were 5 deaths associated with the trial, and 2 were drug-related. And we think these were related to interstitial lung disease. So that is something to be aware of as this drug sort of moves forward in its development. So again, the very impressive response rate of 43% with a disease control rate of 83% was quite notable. And this probably is a new exciting drug for this relatively rare patient population. But again, it didn't seem to matter if they had had prior HER2 therapy, and it definitely didn't seem to matter if they had prior irinotecan. The drug seemed to still have a good effect. So this needs to be further evaluated in larger clinical trials.
So for patients with liver metastases, what data emerged from ASCO that demonstrated some promising findings?
So one very interesting study that was presented at this year's ASCO was the Japanese JCOG-0603 study. And what these investigators were looking at is, should we be giving adjuvant FOLFOX chemotherapy to patients that undergo a curative partial liver resection? And this is a question, a quandary that we frequently struggle with in our clinic and in our tumor boards to know, what are we really doing? Are we really helping? We give chemotherapy for patients with stage 3 colon cancers, high-risk stage 2 colon cancers, so we should probably be doing it for patients with stage 4 colon cancers, but we found out that's not always necessarily the case. So this fairly large Japanese trial across Japan enrolled patients with resected colorectal liver metastases. They could not have had prior oxaliplatin chemotherapy, but they could have had prior other adjuvant chemotherapy. And about half were synchronous colorectal cancer liver metastases, and the other half were metachronous, so that's important to note. But they stratified for both, and also the number and size of liver metastases and positive lymph nodes. So one arm just got observation, one arm got 6 months of standard FOLFOX chemotherapy, and they randomized 300 patients evenly. And the important thing to note was that they actually stopped the study early, strangely, because one primary endpoint of disease-free survival looked a lot better with chemotherapy. So at their initial analysis, the hazard ratio was 0.63, favoring disease-free survival for chemotherapy over surgery alone. And if they looked at the 5-year disease-free survival with surgery alone, it was only 37%, whereas 50% with chemotherapy. So obviously they were concerned about the ethical findings and you know, didn't want to hurt patients by continuing the trial. And this persisted when they updated their analysis for disease-free survival. However, when they looked at their other endpoint of overall survival, the curves actually flipped. So while there was this initial period where chemo and surgery sort of overlap up until about year 3, around years 4 to 5, there's a separation in the curves, and surgery alone actually does better from an overall survival standpoint until the curves basically start to overlap again at 8 years, and then there's less follow-up data. So here, the overall survival is actually inferior with chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 1.25. And the 5-year overall survival with surgery alone was 83%, and with chemotherapy, it actually dropped to 71%, implying that we're actually hurting patients by giving them chemotherapy after the surgery. So this was a pretty stark finding and shows that our sort of surrogate interim endpoints like disease-free survival don't often pan out in these types of analyses. The interesting finding was the pattern of recurrence after liver resection was different. So those who got chemotherapy had less liver metastases and slightly more lung metastases, whereas those who just got surgery alone were slightly more likely to recur in the liver, which is an interesting finding. But overall, there weren't specific subgroups that seemed to do better or worse, including synchronous and metachronous, although there were trends towards metachronous actually doing better with surgery alone. So what does this mean for our clinic? So again, the trial was stopped early because disease-free survival was better with chemo, but it turned out overall survival was better with just surgery alone. And so patients, I think definitely if they're getting surgery for metachronous liver metastases, I probably would not offer adjuvant chemotherapy. I think for patients with synchronous liver metastases, it's something to consider. Again, in this setting, we are typically giving more neoadjuvant chemotherapy prior to even resectable liver metastases. So they may not need as much adjuvant chemotherapy. And this study is a little dirty because patients could have had adjuvant chemo as long as they didn't have prior oxaliplatin. So I think it has kind of confirmed our thinking that for patients with sort of isolated liver metastases that undergo cure, they probably don't need adjuvant chemotherapy.
Moving into the radiation space, could you discuss the RAPIDO study and the investigated regimen from that trial?
Sure. So this was a study out of the Netherlands and conducted in Europe where they were basically trying to research the use of short course radiation. Typically, the standard still in the U.S. and many institutions is to do traditional long course chemo radiation with a fluoropyrimidine and then followed by surgery and then followed by adjuvant therapy. That's sort of shifting in many centers to a so-called total neoadjuvant approach, which usually combines some form of radiation, systemic chemotherapy, and then followed by surgery, often with no subsequent adjuvant therapy. So this study was not quite looking at that, but did compare the standard kind of neoadjuvant chemo radiation followed by surgery, followed by optional adjuvant chemo versus their experimental regimen of 5 days of short course radiation, then followed by 18 weeks of chemotherapy, which typically was CAPOX, though it could have also been FOLFOX, and then followed by surgery thereafter, which does sort of qualify as a total neoadjuvant therapy approach. Patients had to have primary adenocarcinoma of the rectum with no distant metastases, and they had to have high-risk features by MRI criteria. These included T4 disease, extramural vascular invasion, N2 disease, positive mesorectal fascial involvement, or enlarged lateral lymph nodes. And their primary endpoint was a composite that they called disease-related treatment failure, which included a variety of endpoints, including local regional failure, distant failure, et cetera. So the main finding was that the disease-related treatment failure at 3 years was only 23.7% with the short course and 30% with the standard approach. Distant metastases were also decreased 20 to 26.8% with the standard approach. And local regional failure was rare in both arms, but was actually slightly better with the standard approach, 6% versus 8.7% at 3 years. And overall survival, interestingly, was almost exactly the same. It was 89.1% at 3 years with the experimental short course and 88.8% with the standard approach. So what does this mean for our patients? So in the COVID era, we're trying to do more short course across the board because it actually is, you know, less patient visits, patient contact than the traditional 5.5 weeks of 28 fractions of chemo radiation. So if we can accomplish the same thing in five doses without hurting outcomes and without causing unnecessary toxicity, it's definitely favorable. And I think we will see more of a trend towards this because this study kind of shows that there's some advantages to short course. It doesn't seem to make any difference in terms of overall survival, but may include superiority in this sort of composite of time to disease-related failure. And so that was impressive findings, impressive results. And the other very impressive result was the complete pathological response rate with short course was double. It was 28 versus 14%. So we see more dramatic tumor shrinkage, we think, with short course. So I think you may see a trend now towards doing more short course, especially as many are moving towards this total neoadjuvant approach, because it gets the radiation in and out quickly, can get on chemo, can get to surgery much faster. So I think you'll be seeing this kind of incorporated into the institutional recommendations across the country. The other trial that I'm not discussing is the PRODIGE study of trying to integrate FOLFIRINOX, more aggressive chemotherapy induction up front, which also seems to have some favorable characteristics to it. So you may see a combination of these approaches in the future.
And then we saw the final results from the IDEA collaboration. Could you provide some insight into that study and how these long-term data may impact the stage three space?
Yeah, so the IDEA collaboration has really altered the standard of care for patients with resected stage 3 colorectal cancer. it used to be the dogma was everybody gets 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy for a stage 3 colorectal cancer that's removed. That was really challenged by this trial, or really group of trials that randomized patients to 3 versus 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy, could be FOLFOX or CAPOX. That was not randomized. Important to remember, this was a collection of 6 different international trials that were all a little bit different, but did have that fundamental 3 versus 6 randomization, and that they were looking predominantly at non-inferiority, not superiority. And we know, based off the New England Journal publication by Grothy and colleagues from 2018, that in terms of the 3-year disease-free survival, it was technically not non-inferior, but the curves were near overlapping. And so they presented the results of the overall survival at this year's ASCO. And these curves overlap even more, showing that there was really very little absolute difference in 5-year survival rate of 3 versus 6 months. And if you look at the absolute value, it was only a 0.4% difference in overall survival, absolutely, in patients who were got 3 months versus 6 months. So the 6-month 5-year survival was 82.8%, 3 months was 82.4%. So why are we subjecting patients to an additional 3 months of chemotherapy with a definite increased risk of peripheral neuropathy, which can become permanent, if we're only getting a 0.4% absolute overall survival benefit? So weirdly enough, again, this technically was not non-inferior because based on their predefined statistics, their confidence interval crosses the non-inferiority boundary, so they fail to reject the null hypothesis of non-inferiority. So it's technically not non-inferior, but again, the curves overlap almost completely. Now, if they looked by regimen, there was definitely no absolute benefit of continuing CAPOX beyond the 3 months, so the 5-year survival rate actually dipped by 0.9% if you continued for 6 months, so 82.1 versus 81.2%. With FOLFOX, kind of like we saw in the New England Journal publication, there was a slight increase absolutely in continuing beyond the 3 months, so 82.6% 5-year survival with 3 months, 83.8% 5-year survival with 6 months of therapy, so there was a 1.2% absolute increase. And then when they looked by the so-called kind of clinical risk, those with patients with T1 to T3 N1 tumors, there was really no benefit of continuing treatment beyond 3 months, and there actually might be a detriment. Here, the hazard ratio was 0.95, crosses 1, but the absolute numbers, 5-year survival rate, 89.6 with 3 months, 88.9% with 6 months, so there was a 0.7% decrease. Again, the only group that seems to do better with 6 months of therapy is the high-risk group, which is T4 and or N2 tumors, mostly T4, that gets 6 months of chemotherapy. And here there was a 1.7% absolute overall survival increase with the 6 months of therapy, 72% at 5 years versus 74.1% 5-year survival with 6 months. So if you look at the comparison of risk and regimen, pretty much everybody can get away with 3 months of CAPOX. Low risk or high risk, there was really very little survival improvement even in the high risk group, and there was definitely a survival detriment in the low risk group that got CAPOX beyond 3 months, so I would definitely not recommend that. The only group I would consider giving 6 months of therapy to is the high risk group that gets FOLFOX, so the T4 and or N2 tumors. Here, the best numbers we have numerically, it was a 75.3% survival with 6 months of therapy in that group. So that's really the only group I would recommend considering 6 months of therapy. So in conclusion, really, there doesn't seem to be really any large absolute difference of continuing adjuvant chemotherapy beyond 3 months, especially if you're going to get CAPOX. And the only group where I would consider it is the high-risk T4 and or N2 group that gets FOLFOX for 6 months. And we hope that in the future we develop better strategies for trying to make these decisions. One is immunoscore, which looks at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. The group that has higher amounts of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, interestingly, seems to benefit from longer adjuvant chemotherapy. And the other thing is circulating tumor DNA, which is a very hot area of study. It seems to be that patients with, you know, persistently positive ctDNA after 3 months, maybe they should be the ones that should get another 3 months of chemotherapy, although this remains controversial in the subject of ongoing clinical trials.
That's kind of a take-home message. In your opinion, what does the future hold for the treatment of patients with colorectal cancer? How do we kind of incorporate these data into that treatment paradigm?
So I think there's a number of exciting developments for patients with colorectal cancer that were presented at this year's ASCO. I think the use of immunotherapy in the frontline setting for MSI-high patients with metastatic disease is really a change in the standard of care. And I think we'll have a better idea as these other studies evaluating chemo plus immunotherapy or combination immunotherapy studies for this rare but important patient population will help not only development of better therapies for those patients, but may inform therapies for patients that do not have MSI-high or MMR-deficient tumors. Similarly, the HER2-positive group is a rare slice of patients with colorectal cancer, but this development of this new drug, trastuzumab deruxtecan, you know, needs to be evaluated in further larger clinical trials, but is promising for this, again, rare subset of patients with colorectal cancer. For those with more common subclasses of disease, especially those with liver metastases, we know that maybe giving adjuvant chemotherapy after a curative liver resection may not be beneficial from an overall survival standpoint. For those with localized but advanced rectal cancer, short course radiation seems to be a good and viable option that may be especially useful in the COVID era to minimize visits for patients. And then the IDEA collaboration, again, supports that we probably shouldn't be giving more than 3 months of adjuvant chemotherapy for the vast majority of patients with stage three colorectal cancer.
Do you have anything else that you would like to add from either these studies, from practice, from ASCO in general?
It's frustrating to do these meetings virtually. There are definitely some advantages of not having to travel and being able to interact with other providers on social media in real time. However, we do miss the conferences and those sort of sideline discussions and controversies and debates that are not as effective in the virtual setting. So we're cautiously optimistic about being able to participate in in-person meetings next year. And we hope to be back potentially as early at ASCO GI in January of next year in person. But they're trying times in the COVID era for both ourselves, but especially our patients and our patients' families, very taxing on all of them. And we hope that next year will change and be better for us and our patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive.